And welcome to the Midday for a Tuesday with Stephanie.
Good afternoon, Norman.
Good afternoon, Stephanie, and good afternoon to our guest, David Pitzinger. Welcome to our studio.
Thank you very much, Norman.
David Pitzinger.
Say that again. Just listen to that. That's what we call pipes.
He is a Metropolitan Opera bass who is here in town to play the conniving Mephistopheles in the Madison Opera production of Faust coming up this weekend. He has portrayed many wonderful roles, including True Love in a production of The Rake's Progress. And he made his Broadway debut as Emile de Bec in the Tony-winning revival of South Pacific. Thank you so much for coming in this afternoon. We sure appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
If none other, just to listen to those that gorgeous voice.
Well, you were saying just before we went on the air something, I suppose, that would be a bit of a surprise to some of us, and that is not all basses are bad.
No, that's true. You know, there are so many different types of categories within every voice fach, voice fach being voice type. And within those, I mean, I myself would be considered a bass, but some people call me a bass baritone. I oftentimes sing a baritone role. It depends more upon, you know, the color of the voice. Someone like, I don't know, Giaurov, or more recently, Kurt Moll, you know, a real Stehbass, a real low Gornemanz Wagnerian bass. And then there are the more, you know, bas-chantants or basso cantantes, which is more what I am, that a little lither voice, a little lighter, can go in and out of handle, the fioritura, the coloratura.
A little more lyrical,
yeah. There are more options to sort of, you know, decide. It's not so, you know, written in stone that, you know, it's really more about color. The tessitura isn't that much different, but it's more about color. But very often, you know, it's cast that way, where the darker, even if it's a lyric voice, but the darker, lower voice will tend to do the more demonic characters.
Well, you think of the evil baritone like Scarpia, or somebody is always trying to get the soprano from the tenor, and that's.
Yep.
But you mentioned there are many wonderful, loving roles for the deep voice.
Well, there are. When I do Scarpia, I do it very lovingly.
Oh yes, just what a nice guy. Well, I've heard it said of movies. I don't know if it's true of opera so much, though, that, you know, the advantage of being a villain is that you can play it all your life, whereas if you're a leading man in terms of, you know, the heroic role, after a while you get a little bit, what shall we say, past the point of doing Romeo, for example.
Right. In the movies, that's true. You know, in opera, you know, the voice sort of takes on more possibilities, more color, more weight. And if you take care of it, you know, the older that you get, the more flexibility that you have in terms of choosing your repertoire. You know, I would say that's absolutely true. Although, you know, there are people that have very successfully sort of sat on the fence. One that comes to mind was Justino Diaz, who sang, you know, the baritone and bass repertoire, and sang everything from, you know, Zarathustra and Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, Alma Viva, and Figaro himself. And then did things like Iago, you know, in Othello, brilliantly.
Yeah.
So, and did it, you know, right up until, you know, very recently. So, and here's someone who we can remember opened the Metropolitan Opera in you know, the mid-60s, opposite Leontine Price in Antony and Cleopatra, which we just redid for the first time in New York since it was done then. New York City Opera actually sponsored it at Carnegie Hall, which was great, great fun, and a very underrated, underperformed work.
So how does a singer, including a bass, take care of his or her voice? I mean, in some ways it seems obvious, but in other ways, in terms of pacing yourself during the course of a career, how do you know how much to perform and how much not to perform?
You know, probably much the same as you take care of your voice. I mean, it's our livelihood. We depend on it. And so things like, you know, not becoming, you know, overly obsessive with, you know, what we do, but, you know, enough sleep, that sort of thing, keeping travel to, you know, a minimum, which is the most difficult thing in our careers is the travel, the taxing, you know, how taxing that is on the body and the voice. Not just with, you know, dehydration and, you know, time change, but just fatigue. And I think, you know, vocal fatigue happens, to everybody at some time. One hopes that you've reached a point of technical facility where you know how to sort of support the voice, through, I don't know, allergies, for example. Right now, everybody's sort of, you know.
Really? Wow. Now that's something you don't think about, allergies and that.
So the technical facility is something that, you know, you work on in the early years to take you through the times when you're not feeling 100%, because, you know, rarely do you feel, you know, 100%, and yet you have to be able to give 100%. And that's what technique is all about. That's what conservatory training and vocal training is all about. And we use the repertoire to take us through, you know, those things. The repertoire is ideal at that. You know, what singers have the advantage of today that they didn't have, say, 200 years ago, was that we have additional styles. People in Mozart's time were singing Baroque music and Mozart, you know, and then, and that's it. Now we have to be able to span, all those styles, assimilate them, and the languages as well. You know, most of us, aren't singing in our native, tongue, but, you know, that's the advantage of moving through repertoire, because it only, you know, if it's approached well, it only helps the technique and the longevity of the career.
Speaking of the technique, you're on Broadway, you're on opera stages. Are those techniques substantially different?
Yes and no. For example, on Broadway, we do 8 shows a week. And that, when I, you know, first was confronted with that, I thought, there's just no possible way that I'm going to be able to do that. I couldn't do 8 operas a week. But it was written for an opera singer, Ezio Pinza. And it was written so well.
South Pacific we're talking about here.
Yeah. I think that, you know, most of the repertoire written, say, between 1945, 6, that area, to 1965, that 20-year, was heyday period. It was legitimate voices, the Kiley's, the John Cullum's, the John Raitt's, the Alfred Drake, the, you know, all those types of voices that came from the sort of vaudeville mentality, but it required, you know, real voices. Today, it requires real voices, but different. You know, they didn't have amplification then, so the musical style was written to really, really show, enhance, and beautiful lines, and not to tax the voice beyond, you know, its means.
That's true. The styles, for whatever reason, certainly have changed since 1965 or so.
But that's the biggest difference, really, is just the amount of time you actually spend on the stage, you know, in Broadway, you know, with 8 shows a week. I mean, you get up, and my experience was just, I just, you know, put my pants on, couldn't wait to get to the theater, you know. And whatever didn't work maybe last night, you know, you have an option to get it right in a 2-show day. You can try something in the matinee, and, well, that didn't work, but I'll try something different tonight. It's exciting. It's fresh. That's the advantage of live performance, whether it's opera or Broadway.
Oh, for sure, yes. Certainly exciting.
Well, shall we hear opera or Broadway, Norman?
Well, I believe since we started with discussion of Faust, we should hear some Faust with a low voice.
This is Le Veau d'Or, or The Golden Calf. David, would you set this up for us a little bit?
Sure. This is just after the studio scene, when, or what we call the enchantment scene. That scene is where the deal is made between Faust and Mephistopheles. And this is a celebration. It's called the Kermesse. And the Kermesse, they were often done in Europe a few hundred years ago. It was sort of a celebration of the church. And not like an auto da fe, as we see in Don Carlo or something. And this particular number is about the worshiping of idolatry. And it sort of sets the tone for what Mephistopheles has done and what he's going to continue to do with Faust.
Well, a rather cheerful sounding Mephistopheles there, but then of course he's about to have his way for the course of the opera. That was Nikolai Gyarov and the Paris National Opera Orchestra with Georges Braque conducting from Gounod's Faust. Watch out for those golden calf worshippers.
And Faust will be performed this weekend in a production by Madison Opera. That'll be Friday night at 8 and then again Sunday at 2:30 in a matinee performance. And you can find information at madisonopera.org, or the box office number is 608-258-4141. And we are speaking with David Pitzinger, who is our Mephistopheles this weekend.
Now, Mephistopheles is a character that I would think would not provide a lot of room for character development or change. You know, Faust at least learns something through this experience, but Mephistopheles, what do you have to work with?
Oh, I have to beg to differ there. You know, it's great because depending upon the piece, you know, legend and lore of Mephisto comes from many different things. The origins of Satan come from many different things. So in this piece, musically, there's great opportunity both in this, the enchantment, the invocation of the night, certainly the church scene. In one of the earliest sort of written accounts of Faust living in Germany, Christopher Marlowe, I think in his play, has Mephistopheles and Beelzebub and Lucifer all in the church together giving the Pope a hard time.
It starts to sound like a joke, doesn't it?
So, yeah, and the thing is, it's a very sort of impish character. You know, if he's so dark and demonic, no one would follow him. No one would make a deal with him.
Right, like in Paradise Lost.
That's right, right. Yeah. And the suavity of him, as with a lot of these sort of menacing or diabolical or satanic characters, even Don Giovanni, there's something very sensual and suave that makes people want to defect, as it were,
well,
to the dark
earthy,
side.
He's earthy, he's sexy.
Yeah.
The same characteristics attributed to the Byronic hero who runs through much of Gothic
literature. Right. Don Juan.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And I think as well, you know, there have been so many great, you know, depictions of the character from, you know, in Don Juan is one of them, of course. But come to think of some others, Damnation de Faust of Berlioz, another really wonderful, wonderful satanic Mephistopheles with some of the most beautiful music comes to mind. Voici des Roses, which is beautiful. Boito's Mephistopheles. Boito was the librettist for Giuseppe Verdi and wrote his own Mephistopheles, the title character being Mephisto. And it's a very different setting, but of the same lore and legend. And it does offer, there are a lot of doors. For example, the Stravinsky Rake's Progress is one of the greatest, with the greatest room for interpretation, because it's all based on drawings, the Hogarth drawings, lithographs.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And Nick's shadow doesn't appear in any of the drawings. So Is he an idea or a vision of Tom Rakewell or Anne Trulove or the father? Or, you know, so these are all things that become options both musically and dramatically for every director and conductor to work with in whatever production that they're doing.
There are at least a dozen, if not more, operas based on the legend of Faust. Why is this one so successful? It really is, I think, the top one that's performed.
Universality.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, you know, we're all given free rein to have choice, and there are things that come into our lives at different times, and we have the choice to make and follow our own paths and change our paths. So I think that every Faust opera or play, I'm thinking of the Klaus Mann, for example, is able to sort of inflect or inflict a certain sensibility and universality about, you know, issues that we all have in our lives. And it's relevant today as it was, say, 300 or 400 years ago. I'm thinking, yeah, in the late 15th century when you know, Christopher Marlowe was writing about it. So,
yes, the devil does have a kind of a timeless quality, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Universality, that's
yeah.
Right.
And this particular opera has stunning music. It's just beautiful. The waltzes, the arias, there's a trio in the last act that's just gorgeous, mm-hmm. and moving. There's some atmospheric music that's just beautiful.
Yeah, the church scene.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of churches, let's hear next from somebody who actually did have a church influence in his music and a lot of others, and sometimes they all blend at the same time. But mm-hmm. I think not in the early songs so much of Charles Ives.
Shift gears. Yes, David, you've been involved in a recording project featuring composer Charles Ives.
It's been a great experience and an eye-opener. This music was music that I hadn't had great experience with in terms of performance. There wasn't a lot of opportunity. It's underperformed, underrated music. Again, you know, 20th century music, it's so broad. It's so broad. And people don't realize that, you know, Ives, you know, he was composing in the same century as Puccini. We don't think of Puccini as a 20th century composer.
Yeah, right.
That's a great point.
You know, Puccini could have very, very well been at you know, the debut of Zalame. I mean,
With years to spare.
Exactly. So it's been a great project. I think it's brought to light a lot of the best aspects of Ives' music. I think our ears are maybe more open to it than we would have been in retrospect. I think that he'll be, as many composers are, much more revered, you know.
That's already
since
happened.
His death. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's right.
So.
We're going to hear a song from actually the late 19th century, from 1898, Because of You. This is our guest, bass David Pitzinger, with the music of Charles Ives.
This grim old world looks gold and bright because of you.
Well, you wouldn't take that as the music of Charles Ives, I don't think, unless you were really well acquainted with his early songs.
And that was a song called Because of You, written in 1898, and that was a performance by our guest David Pitzinger. And it's part of a project on the Naxos label featuring the early work of Charles Ives, and I gather it's an ongoing project.
It's been completed, but it is not just the early works. There are, I think, a total of 5 volumes at least of this, and it's all his vocal work. And, you know, his work is very thematic in composition and experimental, much like, you know, Britten later got very experimental in his works.
Yes.
And Ives did as well, but it was really an eye-opening experience because his melody, his gift for melody, is is really incredible. This, along with Because Thou Art, Slow March, some of the others that you can download on iTunes or, you know, from the Naxos website. It's it was really eye-opening because he always comes back to great melody, and sometimes the piano part is set very differently. It's like a duet, and things go off in different directions. But it's a really great body of work that he did for vocal music and American vocal music.
Well, let's see if we can squeeze in one more bit of music between now and the quiz question. It'll be more like a 12:35 quiz question today. You're a particular fan, I gather, and since you're singing in South Pacific, it's good to have some kind of a guiding light from previous performers, and yours would be Ezio Pinza.
He was my idol growing up. He was who I tried to sound like. I met his daughter, who is a teacher in Pittsburgh, Claudia Pinza. He's had the sort of revered career that we all sort of aspire to, and played a big part in why and how this role was written the way it was.
Brought an operatic sound to a Broadway part.
They required an operatic sound to this this Frenchman, as it were, a French plantation owner, Emile Debec. And he and Mary Martin teamed up on Broadway, and there's very little that they sing together.
I think thereby hangs a tale.
Yeah, exactly. She was very worried about, you know, her musical wiles put against an opera singer's, and he was very worried about such an arduous week with so many performances that we don't do an opera. You know, if we do two or three a week, that's a big week. You know, you need time to rest in between. So he had a lot to say about how much he would sing. Therefore, I think this twin soliloquies and one other maybe 8 or 10 second little duet in the first act is all they sing together in South Pacific. And nobody realizes it because it has such impact. You know, it seems like they're all singing, you know, all night and together. Mm-hmm. But that's the great thing about the book. In opera, we call it the libretto. In musical theater or Broadway, we call it the book. With Rodgers and Hammerstein and Josh Logan together, the surprise isn't just of this iconic music, but of the dialogue.
Wonder how I'd feel living on a hillside, looking on an ocean beautiful and still.
This is what I need, this is what I've longed for, someone young and smiling climbing up my hill.
We are not alone.
Wow, there really wasn't very much there together, was there?
No, no.
Music from South Pacific.
And from, a performer much admired by our guest today, who will be and has been much admired in his various bass and bass baritone roles.
And that is David Pitzinger. He will be appearing as Mephistopheles this weekend in a performance of Madison Opera's Faust, Gounod's Faust, and that's Friday night, May 15th at 8 p.m., and then again Sunday the 17th at 2:30. That's at the Overture Center. You can find more information at madisonopera.org, or you can call the box office at 608-258-4141. Well, thank you very much, David Pitzinger, for coming in and talking with us today. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.